Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service, with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Alex Ritson, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday the 10th of July, these are our main stories. The British ambassador to the United States, Sir Kim Darroch, has resigned following the leaking of his frank observations about Donald Trump. The Foreign Office says the president's refusal to work with Britain's representative is unprecedented. The International Nuclear Watchdog is holding a special meeting to discuss Iran's breaches of its nuclear treaty. Also in this podcast, the UN says that 11 million people in North Korea are in need of food aid. And the search is finally beginning in Colombia for the estimated 80,000 people who disappeared during half a century of armed civil conflict.
It's heartbreaking to see the suffering of these families. And because their loved ones were apparently disappeared by paramilitary groups, which officially no longer exist, according to the government anyway, they're not classed as victims of the conflict.
And seagulls in Australia are found to be carrying drug-resistant superbugs. We begin this podcast with the announcement that the British ambassador to the United States has resigned following a row about his criticism of the Trump administration. Sir Kim Darroch said the current situation was making it impossible for him to carry out his role as he would like. On Monday, the ambassador was criticised by Donald Trump in a series of tweets after leaked emails described the president's administration as inept and dysfunctional. Speaking in Parliament, the British Prime Minister, Theresa May, said Sir Kim's decision was a matter of great regret and insisted he had the support of the Cabinet.
Good government depends on public servants being able to give full and frank advice. I want all our public servants to have the confidence to be able to do that. And I hope the House will reflect on the importance of defending our values and principles, particularly when they are under pressure.
Our political correspondent Rob Watson told me more about this extraordinary turn of events and why Sir Kim had decided to resign now.
He said that essentially, while he was due to stay until the end of the year, he just felt that he couldn't carry on in his role after what had happened. Essentially what he's done is that he has fallen on his sword. But a part of that sword has given a good old poking to Boris Johnson, because we at the BBC and others have learned that one of the reasons why Sir Kim decided to resign is that he was watching the TV debate in the UK between Boris Johnson and Jeremy Hunt, the other man vying to take over from Theresa May. And when Boris Johnson failed, despite being asked several times to stand by Sir Kim, apparently the ambassador decided, maybe I better go rather than be pushed. And of course, the way this is now, one imagines, going to play out over the next few hours is people to say, hang on a minute, so Boris Johnson has decided to prioritise not upsetting President Trump rather than sticking by Her Majesty's man in Washington. And I don't think that's a very good look for Boris Johnson at all. Now, I suspect that just like everything else in this country now, reaction will be kind of polarised along Leave Remain lines. So I'm sure lots of Brexiteers will say, this is a load of old nonsense. The ambassador shouldn't have said these things. He's doing the right thing. And it doesn't reflect badly at all on Boris Johnson. Whereas those on the Remain side of the equation will be saying, my goodness, is this really a person, Boris Johnson, who should be Prime Minister, if this is the kind of damage he's done as candidate Johnson?
Do we know any more about this leak, where it came from? It's clearly upset President Trump.
We don't know where it's come from. And I mean, my suspicion would be is that it was leaked by someone who's very much in favour of the necessary pivot from Brussels to Washington, inherent in the decision of Britain to vote to leave the European Union. That was always going to happen. I mean, I suspect the motive of the person who leaked it was to say, and therefore, this is a great thing, this pivot away from Brussels to Washington, and the UK should have someone in its embassy there who really believes in it and who believes in this closer, brighter relationship with the United States post-Brexit. I mean, that's just a theory, but it seems the most likely explanation.
But as I said, President Trump is furious. Where does this leave US-UK relations, often said to be special.
The relationship will endure, there's no doubt about that. But I think at a more basic level, at a more important sort of existential level, it does highlight this issue that Brexiteers and leavers have to deal with, which is if Britain is leaving the European Union, that will mean a realignment closer to the United States. How do you manage that realignment when there is someone as difficult to handle for foreign politicians in the White House as President Donald Trump?
Rob Watson. Nick Bryant told us the ambassador's position had become untenable.
Donald Trump will be thinking he's probably got veto power over who should be the UK ambassador in Washington. And it wasn't so much those mocking tweets that did for Sir Kim Darroch. It was his digital edict delivered via Twitter on Monday night that his administration would not deal with him. Access is everything for an ambassador. And Sir Kim Darroch did have very good access. He was close to a number of senior aides in the Trump White House, people like Kellyanne Conway, people like Stephen Miller, who's a very close aide of the president, those survivors who have survived all the turmoil and the staff comings and goings. Sir Kim was pretty close to them. But when Donald Trump said he would be denied access, well, he meant it. And it came into immediate effect. On Monday night, he was disinvited from a dinner that was held at the Treasury in honour of the Emir of Qatar. On Tuesday, he was unable to attend a meeting at the White House with a senior British minister and Ivanka Trump, the president's daughter. That was his decision that he didn't go, but it was by no means certain that he was going to be welcome. His job had become untenable. As he himself wrote, it was impossible to carry out his position, so he went. Ambassadors need access, and Sir Kim Darroch have been denied it.
Nick Bryant. The UN nuclear watchdog is holding an emergency meeting at the request of the US to discuss the crisis over Tehran's nuclear program. The US is hoping to increase pressure on Iran at the meeting of the IAEA. For more than a year, European powers have been struggling to keep the Iran nuclear deal alive after President Trump pulled the US out of the pact. Now, Tehran, which has already violated a cap on uranium enrichment, has said it will further breach nuclear limits unless the Europeans provide compensation for the sanctions imposed by Washington. Iran's ambassador at the United Nations, Majid Takht Ravanchi, told the BBC that Europe's leaders have not held up their end of the deal.
When President Trump decided to get out of the nuclear deal, we were approached by three European leaders encouraging us, insisting Iran not to get out of the nuclear deal, and they promised us to do exactly what they were supposed to do to compensate what we have lost as a result of the U.S. withdrawal. So it is not acceptable to us to see that the Europeans are not honoring their commitments.
I asked our diplomatic correspondent, Jonathan Marcus, what Iran had said about its possible next steps.
It's saying that it's going to keep on trying to up the pressure on the Europeans and others to try and ensure that it gets what it believes it's due under the terms of the agreement that it signed. The problem, of course, is that the Americans have withdrawn from that deal. It's America that is applying the crippling secondary sanctions against Iran. With the best will in the world, though the Europeans want Iran to stay in the deal, there's a very restricted limit as to what the Europeans can do to try to compensate for the pressure that they are under. There's a whole range of things Iran could do. They could up the level of enrichment of uranium in various stages. That could be a protracted process, but they could keep on raising that. They could take other steps to break terms of the agreement. Ultimately, they potentially could remove international inspectors from their facilities or deny them access. And at the very end of the day, I suppose they could threaten to withdraw from the non-proliferation treaty. Where that would get Iran, I don't know. All of the inevitable direction here is towards a potential clash with the United States. So it's very difficult to see how this ends.
Meanwhile, Washington will use today's emergency meeting at the UN's nuclear watchdog to put more pressure on Iran.
Well, absolutely. The Americans are trying to galvanise what they would see as an international coalition against Iran. I think the Europeans are going to be very wary at that meeting. They don't want to do anything, as it were, that signals the end of the road. They want this road to go on as long as possible. They're very loath to decide that the Iran nuclear deal, the JCPOA as it's called, is dead. That deal does have various procedures that can be implemented for looking into breaches and so on and so forth. But again, as we've seen from the French, you know, the emphasis with the Europeans is very much on diplomacy to try and find a way through this crisis that keeps Iran inside the nuclear deal.
Jonathan Marcus. The United Nations official investigating the murder of the Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi has called on the American CIA to declassify its intelligence on the killing. Speaking at a human rights event in London, Agnes Callamard said that so far she'd received what she described as minimal help from Washington. Our security correspondent Frank Gardner reports.
In a packed auditorium hosted by Amnesty International, the UN Special Rapporteur investigating the Jamal Khashoggi murder delivered a simple message. Agnes Callamard said that if the world did not take action to show that killing the journalist inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul carried a price, then it would embolden others to act with impunity. Her six-month investigation has led her to conclude that the Saudi state, not individuals, was behind the murder last October. She wants the UN to appoint a criminal investigation to identify exactly who in the Saudi government ordered it and who else was aware of it. Saudi Arabia initially denied any part in Mr. Khashoggi's death, but has since put 11 men on trial. Ms. Callamard accused the Saudi authorities of failing to properly investigate the murder, but the Saudi Minister of State for Foreign Affairs has dismissed her report as being biased and factually incorrect. He has ruled out allowing independent investigators coming to Saudi Arabia to question the suspects on trial.
Frank Gardner. Journalism is becoming an increasingly dangerous profession. Reporters are more likely than ever to be caught in the crossfire of military conflicts. They're also increasingly under attack from authoritarian governments and from populist politicians who seek to bully and intimidate them online. Today in London, a group of journalists, politicians and civil society organisations are meeting to discuss some of these issues. My colleague Naomi Grimley caught up with two of the reporters who'll be there.
Last year was a terrible year for journalists across the world. 99 were killed, 348 detained, and 60 held hostage by non-state groups. Well, to draw attention to this, the British Foreign Office is joining forces with the Canadian government this week to hold a conference on global media freedom. And I'm lucky enough to have two famous journalists with me, Maria Ressa from the Philippines and Sonny Sui from Myanmar. Now, both of them have had to contend with persecution at the hands of authoritarian governments. Maria, let me start with you, because you are still being harassed by the government of President Duterte in the Philippines. Tell me a bit more.
At this point in time, there are more than 11 investigations and cases that are live. I've had to post bail 8 times in a 3-month period, and I was arrested twice and detained once over a 5-week period. So I can spend 4 days of a week in court, and of course that's a war of attrition, right? And you take the weaponization of the law, and then you add weaponization on social media, which is how it all began, and it's tough to be a journalist today.
And tell me a bit more about what your platform, Rappler, is trying to do. What kind of stories are upsetting the government there? Why are they persecuting you in this way?
So we're a startup in 2012, but the end goal of Rappler, I think why we were targeted, was because we challenged impunity. It's impunity in the drug war. The UN estimates at least 27,000 people killed brutally since July of 2016, and impunity of online operations, online information operations, social media, how that's been used to insidiously affect the public sphere. We're a cautionary tale. You know, the Filipinos spend the most time online and on social media. And in the Philippines, 97% of the Filipinos on the internet are on Facebook. So Facebook is truly our internet, much like Myanmar.
Talking of which, Sonny, you actually spent time in jail because of your profession. It is a reminder, isn't it, that journalists have to be incredibly brave in some countries across the world?
Definitely, yes. Very high risk. And I will always say this, it's the wrong time to be in media because journalists are still being charged or sued or detained. And then also the survival or sustainability of independent media, it's quite difficult at this point. So yes, very challenging.
And of course, you were in jail under the military regime in Myanmar, but now we still have a problem, don't we, with freedom of speech in Myanmar, even when the government is led by a former Nobel Peace Prize laureate.
Correct. When it comes to press freedom, compared to 10, 12 years ago, we're doing very well, actually. But if we compare the press freedom today to 3 years ago, we are kind of going backwards, yes.
Burmese journalist Sonny Sway ending that report by Naomi Grimley. Seagulls snatching your fish and chips at the seaside may not be the worst they can do to you. Scientists in Australia have discovered that seagulls all over Australia are carrying superbugs resistant to antibiotics. Some silver gulls have bacteria such as E. coli, which can cause urinary tract infections, sepsis and blood infections. Dr. Sam Abraham is a lecturer in veterinary and medical infectious disease at Murdoch University in Perth in Western Australia and is one of the authors of the study. He says the gulls have picked up the bugs from swimming in sewage.
The gulls are definitely picking up human bacteria that colonizes the human gut. So it has to be human fecal material that the gulls are getting in touch with. So nappies or incontinent pads or nursing homes, probably the likely sources where the gulls are picking them up from.
And how did you discover this? What did you measure in the gulls?
So we took fresh seagull droppings from all different parts of Australia and then cultured them in the presence of antibiotics. These are antibiotics that are very important to human health, and this is one of the ones that WHO is very concerned, and we need to prolong their use as much as possible.
Seagulls are everywhere. Coastal, yes, but you see them in the middle of London as well. So how dangerous is it that if they're, and of course we're talking about Australia, no suggestion yet that this will be found anywhere else, but how dangerous is it that the transmission to humans will then increase the spread of these antibiotic-resistant bacteria?
Yes, it is one of the possibilities that the drug-resistant bacteria can get into humans. We haven't done the exact public health impact studies yet, but there is a possibility that these bacteria can come through from here, fresh seagull dropping into human fecal oral route into humans, and it can, you know, it's another way that the gulls could spread them. And we think they are a bit like sponges; they pick up all these resistant bacteria, and then when they do the pooing around in the areas where we go and spend time, and we can get in touch with them. So we don't know the exact public health risk at this stage.
So what will you do next to try and establish that? And is there anything that can be done to clear this up in the gulls?
It's very hard because we see in every single state in Australia, we see these bacteria now become sort of part of the gut bacteria of the gulls. We don't think we can do anything to treat the gulls, but we could perhaps look at ways of gulls picking any new superbugs that would emerge in humans. So looking at can we scare them away from the landfill sites, and can we not get the birds swim in sewage treatment areas? So we can't really treat the gulls. Right. It's in their gut already.
Dr. Sam Abraham speaking to Dan Damon. Still to come in this podcast, how Spanish hits are topping the most watched video charts on YouTube. This one's clocked up more than 1.4 billion views. North Korea is experiencing its worst drought in decades, and the UN says that 11 million people in the country are in need of food aid. Crop monitoring researchers say the production of two of its most important crops is expected to decline further than originally forecast. GeoGlam, an agricultural group set up by the G20 countries, says that wheat and barley production in North Korea was originally expected to fall by 20%, but final yields won't even reach predicted levels. Celia Hatton is our Asia Pacific editor.
We already knew that North Korea was suffering from its worst drought in almost four decades. But now we're learning that wheat and barley production, those are two really important crops that North Koreans were expecting to come in the fall. Original predictions would be that the crops would have shrunk by about 20%. And now it looks like that is going to be even worse. That's because basically North Korea is dealing with about half as much water as it had last year, and it simply just can't keep the crops alive.
So just how much of this has to do with sanctions?
A huge amount, to a certain extent. Look, if you compare North Korea, which has about 11 million people in urgent need of food assistance, with South Korea, which is dealing with an obesity problem, you know, you only have to think about that to know that sanctions are probably having a huge effect on this. But also, it's the political system that's in place in North Korea that ensures that any food aid that goes in, for example, South Korea sending in 50,000 tons of rice via the World Food Program, is probably going to benefit the elites in Pyongyang first, and really the people who are living in the countryside who aren't as well politically connected are going to be punished and they're going to face the worst of this. Now, of course, sanctions don't prevent food aid from being shipped in, but international food agencies are saying donations are way down. People, countries simply aren't giving money towards North Korea. That's because there is a huge amount of skepticism that the amount of food aid that's given will simply go to continuing to prop up the North Korean regime.
And that really leaves a question over the whole program of food aid.
Yeah, it's a huge problem. I mean, look, the real issue is that famine is a real threat in North Korea. In the 1990s, between 2 million and 3.5 million people died because of hunger in North Korea. And that really does put the whole system under pressure. But food aid organizations are saying, look, we still need these donations to come in. Deaths over famine are a real concern now.
Celia Hatton. Nearly 3 years after Colombia's peace agreement established a transitional justice system, the search is finally beginning for the estimated 80,000 people who went missing during half a century of armed civil conflict. The Unit for the Search of Disappeared Persons, known as the UPBD, has begun taking testimony from victims' families, as Matthew Charles reports from the northeastern city of Bucaramanga.
What's now called the Park of Life in Bucaramanga used to be a place of death, the city cemetery. To make way for more green space and an outdoor gym in the city, the local council exhumed 1,000 unidentified bodies. Local authorities were not able to tell me how the corpses were disposed of, if they were moved elsewhere or burned. These were 1,000 bodies that now may never be reunited with their loved ones.
Bueno, estamos en el Parque de la Vida, antiguo cementerio.
For local activist Cesar Herrera Bernal, whose own father was disappeared in 2002, the removal of the bodies is a sign of the authorities' indifference towards forced disappearance.
In Colombia, it's the same when they rob your phone as when they disappear your relative. This hurts me and generates a demotivation, sadness and discouragement.
In cemeteries across Colombia, there are an estimated 20,000 unidentified corpses. But this is just a small percentage of the tens of thousands who were forcibly disappeared during decades of bloody conflict. Clandestine graves are often found in rough terrain. Finding and identifying them is going to be a mammoth task for the UPBD. Members of paramilitary groups formed by landowners in the 1990s to guard against attacks by the leftist FARC rebels account for most disappearances, according to official statistics. These militia officially demobilized between 2003 and 2006, but some remain or reformed, and these resurgent groups are being blamed for Colombia's recent upsurge in violence as they try to increase their share of the illicit drugs trade. The International Red Cross says that between 2017 and 2018, disappearances linked to Colombia's armed conflict increased by 90%. They say one person disappears every 4 days. The Colombian government says it remains committed to peace, but for Cesar Herrera Bernal, the peace process has become a joke.
Peace is no more disappeared. Peace is a real demobilization of the emergent paramilitary groups.
Well, I'm in the main park in Lebrija on the outskirts of Bucaramanga. It's known as the pineapple capital of Colombia because you're never far from a stall selling pineapples. But it's also a key location on the major drug trafficking route from the Magdalena Medio region through to Venezuela and the Atlantic coast. It's a hideout for paramilitary groups, and in the past 2 years there have been 3 reported cases of disappearances here. But locals say the real number is much, much higher. They say people are too scared to go to the police. Abel Chacon is a dairy farmer. He drives me through the town, showing me the last known whereabouts of his son Erwin, who disappeared in 2017. The 25-year-old went out to deliver milk, but never returned.
Yes, this town has always been violent. It's not a secret. There are people who are afraid. It's the law of silence.
It's heartbreaking to see the suffering of these families. And because their loved ones were apparently disappeared by paramilitary groups, which officially no longer exist, according to the government anyway, they're not classed as victims of the conflict. It means they don't get compensation, and it means their cases are not counted as forced disappearance in official statistics.
Matthew Charles with that report. Given its popularity around the globe, the video-sharing website YouTube is a good place to assess the world's music tastes. According to the latest chart of the most-watched music videos on YouTube, it's showing a move towards Spanish chart toppers. Latin hits make up half the top 10, and there's just a single song sung in English. David Lewis looks at why tastes might be changing.
This is Daddy Yankee's Con Calma, in case you already didn't know that, which heads the charts of YouTube's top 10. The Puerto Rican singer's hit, featuring fast cars, dance troupes and a rapper with the superimposed head of an emoji character, has racked up a phenomenal 1.4 billion views so far this year. But it's not alone in being a runaway Spanish-speaking success. Half of the top 10 this year are tracks in the same language. Reggaeton smash Secreto is in second place, while Catalonian singer Rosalia's duet with J Balvin, Con Altura, also makes it into the top 5. There's just a single song sung in English to make the shortlist, Ariana Grande's electro-pop hit Seven Rings. So is the world turning its back on tunes sung in English? Well, Sebastian Kreese, a Grammy Award winner who's worked with Latin stars Shakira, Luis Fonsi and Gloria Estefan, might have the answer, putting the globalising of music down to the spread of streaming services like Spotify. Before, music was created by the record industry gatekeepers, who were generally middle-class, middle-aged white men. And now it's curated by the masses, the Argentinian producer told the BBC last year. Asian artists also feature prominently. South Korea girl group Blackpink and their K-pop boy band counterpart BTS have more than 900 million views between them for their 2 songs. And a couple of Bollywood tracks also make the grade. One of those, 21-year-old Dhvani Banashali's Vasta song, has clocked up more than 400 million clicks so far this year. The Hindi singer is signed to India's biggest record label, T-Series, which also runs the world's second largest YouTube channel. The love song is the 9th most viewed song of 2019 so far. New York Times music writer Joe Coscarelli maybe put it best. He wrote, "Language is no longer a barrier. World rhythms mix and cohere. Cross-cultural collaboration is common, and hip-hop influence seeps in from all sides."
David Lewis reporting. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Alex Ritson. Until next time, goodbye. If you want to hear details of another podcast you might be interested in, here goes.
That's me drinking millions of viruses.
Crowd Science is the podcast that takes your questions and turns them into audio adventures.
My question for Crowd Science is, why and when did humans first start cooking food?
It's all fire!
I'm Marnie Chesterton, and each week we put your questions to scientists working at the limits of human knowledge.
I wanted to know how cells
How do they know what to do?
They're yanking on their neighbours. They're pushing on their neighbours.
We also try and demonstrate exactly what they're telling us.
What are the limits of human endurance?
You've just run a marathon and been hit by a car. How are you?
That's Crowd Science from the BBC World Service.
So if you'd like to inject a bit more science into that,
just search for Crowd Science wherever you get your podcasts.
I knew it. Amazing.
A good night's sleep is going extinct. The rise of tech and stress in the modern world is keeping people awake. Some are even turning to cat memes to get them through the night. IKEA is here to help with everything you need to build up your rest reserves. Stylish bedding, supportive mattresses, and unique bed frames. So you can stop cat memeing and start cat napping. See what I did there? Discover new ways to save your sleep today.